Fear not what you do not know, fear only what you know to be true. As a biological scientist, I am drawn to animals that others feel are safer to ignore. As an adventurer, I am drawn to places others feel it is safer not to go. As a person, I constantly find myself standing a little bit closer to the edge. It's the only way I can truly see what is out there. My name is Mitch Lademan, and this is a little podcast called Bike Club. Why Bike Club? Well, personally, I've spent most of my life working with the least loved fauna of Australia, the dangerous ones, and that has implications. More generally, Bike Club is a bit of a metaphor for a life lived where one does things a little bit differently and life bites back sometimes. Maybe you can relate to that. If you are into fossils, dinosaurs, global extinctions, primordial soups, and the emergence of slimy, lobed fin fishes from the murky depths up onto dry land during the Devonian period, then you probably most likely believe that Charles Darwin hit a home run with his theories on evolution and natural selection. That is, if a particular individual of a particular species just happens to be born with a fantastic new and novel trait that improves its chances of survival, then that individual will likely have a wonderful life and make lots of babies that will also possess that same trait. These babies will then grow up and make lots more strong, fit, and healthy babies. And so on it goes until this fancy new trait becomes inked into the genotype or the genetic blueprint of the species. Pity all of the remaining individuals of the species that are not born with that special trait, as according to Darwin and most other evolutionary biologists of the era, they will simply wither on the vine. In short, they will not produce very many happy babies, each of whom will drag itself through a miserable existence and most likely die before they get to experience the joy of childbirth and the uplifting experience that is parenting. As a consequence, their genetic blueprint, their origin and their ancestry will simply fade into obscurity. Too bad, so sad, but such is the power of natural selection. When it comes to the paradigms of evolution and survival of the fittest, most people believe that Charles Darwin was right and everybody else was wrong, wrong, wrong. Maybe that is true, but maybe it's not. We all agree that over geological time, and we are talking millions of years here, not days and weeks, an organism's natural environment is constantly changing. Darwin's theory of evolution and natural selection fed from this constant change and a species' urgent need to stay on top of that change. With change comes challenge. Organisms must adapt, evolve, and overcome in order to continue their species. If they don't, they die. But what if you possessed a whole bunch of really neat traits that were not particularly useful now, but were going to become useful in the very near future? Moreover, what if when a change came, you did not need to adapt, evolve, and overcome because you already happened to possess the perfect body plan? You did not need to evolve because you and those within your species, genus, family, or even order already possessed the traits needed to survive in a new radical world order. All of a sudden, we see that there may be more than one explanation as to how organisms have existed over time. More than one explanation for the origin of the species. Published on the 24th of November 1859, this work was considered to be the foundation of evolutionary biology. Charles Darwin is not wrong, not by any stretch, but he was not necessarily all right either. Whatever the case, his ideas dominated the minds of evolutionary theorists for decade upon decade. But there is another explanation for how organisms we see around us every day came to be. And believe it or not, The best examples come from the least loved and who most naively consider the most under-evolved group in the world, the snakes. One very simple comparison of two separate populations of the Western tiger snake can be used to poke holes in Darwin's theory of evolution and natural selection. How? Well, quite simply, two populations of the same snake survive in two radically different environments. One lives in freshwater lakes in suburban Perth, Western Australia, and the other lives on a nearshore island less than 5 kilometres from Perth's coastline. These two populations of tiger snake are genetically identical. They have not evolved, adapted, or capitalized on any radical mutations at birth. They just happen to be extremely tolerant to a broad range of ecological challenges that would quickly kill off other less hardy organisms. They have the perfect body plan and they know how to use it. For example, tiger snakes at Herdsman's Lake don't really demonstrate any urgency to drink fresh water. Why would they? They are surrounded by the stuff all year. And the prey they eat, frogs, are basically saturated sponges with legs. But on Karnak, it's a different story. On Karnak Island, for the majority of the year, there is no fresh water available to drink and there's not enough water generated from prey consumption and digestion to keep a snake going. As a consequence, Karnak snakes go bananas over the water that becomes available during summer thunderstorms. That makes perfect sense. But would you believe they display this response whether they are thirsty or not? Basically, they react opportunistically to available water whether they need it or not. If it rains, they emerge from their water-conserving burrows where they have been dodging the heat and aridity for months at a time, like a swarm of bees out of a hive, to drink as much water as they can, as quick as they can. What's even more interesting is their ability to determine salty water from fresh. With snakes often drinking off their own bodies to avoid taking in salty water off the ground, a phenomenon only ever recorded by science in one other species of snake. In contrast, summer thunderstorms mean nothing to Herdsman's Lake snakes, whether they are thirsty or not. Is the evolution of this behaviour an outcome of natural selection? No, it is not. Less than 1 kilometre across the water is Garden Island. There are tiger snakes on Garden Island too. But as they look and behave identical to the rest of the mainland population, they are of little interest to you and I. No disrespect meant. A far more interesting story persists within the island's population of giant southwest carpet pythons. Insular gigantism is a common phenomenon, particularly within reptiles. Basically, if you have the ideal basic body plan, as reptiles do, and you can manage to swallow huge prey, then you will get big, very big. But on Garden Island, the story is just that little bit more interesting. From neonate, that's newborn, to mature adult pythons, many of the individuals only grow to about 1.5 metres in length, which is kind of a standard size for southwest carpet pythons, and they weigh not much more than a kilogram. However, many adults, typically males, can grow to 5 metres in length and weigh several kilograms. If that was not basis enough for a good story, then ponder this. There are very few individuals on the island that fall into the size and weight range around the middle of this growth spectrum. Thus, this population is extremely unique in having a bimodal size distribution. If you were to graph the population size, you would have two peaks showing high numbers of snakes around the 1 to 2 meter mark and then high numbers of snakes around the 4 to 5 meter mark, separated by a trough with hardly any individuals between 2 and 4 meters. Why? More important than why is how is that interesting? From birth to young adult, both male and female snakes feed on a range of small prey, including mice, rats, lizards, and nestling chicks. At maturity, the females choose to invest all of their energy into breeding, which limits their capacity to grow much larger than they need to in order to bear young. As in many animal groups, the female always seems to be the gender, making the sacrifice to continue the species. The lazy male just continues to eat and accrue resources that it just invests into more growth and the pursuit of more females. Sound familiar? Where this story becomes remarkable is right at the point in size and weight that a python is fortunate enough to take down its first juvenile Tamar wallaby, of which there are thousands on Garden Island. Once they are big enough to take one, they quickly grow bigger and bigger and are far more capable of taking larger Tamar wallabies more frequently. Their growth rate explodes to the point where they attain a size only limited by their ability to stay alive. This predator-prey interaction dictates that the population exists as two subpopulations: the giant gluttonous snakes that feed on the five-star Michelin plate winning wallaby, and the smaller individuals that have to make do with their three-star diet of house mouse and lizard. Okay, so far we have looked at two individual populations of two different types of snakes, where those individual populations vary radically from all of the rest of the populations of those same species of snakes elsewhere. But genetically, the snakes are the same. It's just these snakes on these islands are doing something different, and that difference is happening without genetic change. So this is not natural selection here. This is something different. This is change without natural selection. In my lifetime as a biologist, edging into nearly 40 years spent pouncing on my quarry, I've only ever seen 3 death adders in the wild. The name is derived from the term death adder, arising from the observation that one could virtually stand atop of these cryptic creatures, and like a sniper, they would not give away their position. That's not to say that they're impossible to find, they're just hard to find. But they're also hard to find because in their normal environment, they're very, very thin on the ground. In their normal environment where they occur, their prey is hard for them to source, so therefore their numbers are quite low. Their environment has a low carrying capacity, so therefore their populations are small. But that's not the case on the islands of the archipelago of Recherche. On some of those islands, death adders are everywhere, and everywhere that they are obvious. Why? Why on these islands are they abundant? Why are they everywhere? Why are they everywhere in full view? Well, there's a couple of reasons. Again, these snakes are responding to their environment and they're changing without any genetic change at all. On the islands, the prey are everywhere. So they don't need to hide. They don't need to be cryptic and wiggle their tail next to their mouth to attract a lizard in order to eat it. There's lizards everywhere. So they're foraging just like normal snakes. And there's also a lack of predators as well. Not an absence of predators, but a lack of predators. So they also don't need the crypsis to avoid predation. Another population of snakes behaving completely differently again. This is not natural selection. In this instance, it's sheer laziness and an island paradise changing the population dynamics of these island death adders. When you start to consider dugongs on Rottnest Island and mulga snakes on Barrow Island and the famous Chapel Island tiger snakes, not to mention rough-scaled pythons and the Arafura file snake, I could go on and on and on. Darwin's theory of natural selection starts to look a little bit shaky. And it starts to have you searching for other explanations for how animals have existed the way they are for so long. Whew, crikey, that was a big one. Biggest podcast so far. I hope you could follow that. It's all in my head. Sometimes it's hard to communicate exactly where I'm going, but I hope you get the idea that Darwin's theory of natural selection is not the only explanation for how things came to be the way they are. Catch you next time on Bike Club.